Forletta Investigates.
Welcome to Forletta Investigates. Investigative security consultant Larry Forletta is a highly decorated former DEA agent and member of the Maryland State Police. Forletta Investigates aims to provide information on real-life encounters involving law enforcement, drug trafficking, and actual investigations. Listen to the show every Tuesday as we approach topics of crime and other issues affecting our communities with someone who has worked within law enforcement for over 25 years. Here is your host, Larry Forletta.
Well, hello, everyone. I want to welcome you to my podcast, Forletta Investigates. I'm honored today to have our next guest. His name is Robert Almonte. He's a former deputy chief of the El Paso, Texas Police Department. He had been there for at least 25 years. He was a commander in the narcotics unit. So as most people are aware that, you know, El Paso is on the border, and our border every day at this point is being challenged. It had always been a challenge as far as I know and working when I was with DEA. So, Robert, I want to welcome you to our show.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it, and it truly is an honor. Thank you.
And, Robert, you've literally become an expert on the Mexican cartels and their patron saints, and I know you traveled throughout the United States training law enforcement. So let's talk a little bit about your career and how you started in law enforcement.
Yeah, sure thing, Larry. I started my career with the El Paso Police Department in 1978, graduated from the academy, and went straight to patrol. And I worked patrol shift work day, evening, and graveyard rotating shifts. And I worked in an area that was really, really busy, a lot of crime close to the border, and I was thankful for that. And the reason I was thankful for that was because I really learned a lot. I learned fast. I learned a lot. I like to think I grew up in the El Paso Police Department and talk about culture shock when I put that uniform on, started working the street. So I grew up in the police department. And then 1981, I was selected to go to the department tactical unit, and that's where we're a plainclothes unit. We did a lot of different things. We did dignitary protection. We worked with Secret Service when we had the president, vice president coming in into town. We also were the riot control team for the El Paso Police Department. When we weren't doing that, we were focusing on in-progress crimes, catching burglars and convenience store robbers in the act. So I did that for a few years, learned a lot there, and then 1985 promoted to a detective, and right off the promotional list went straight to narcotics. So we had no formal training back there, and they didn't send me to a school. They just put me together with a partner who, by the way, had only been there a few months himself. So it was OJT, and I don't recommend that to anyone anymore. It was really OJT, but you know, we learned fast, and then we started going to some training conferences, the Texas Narcotic Officers Association's conference, and started learning more. So got to work a lot of interesting cases. Started off any narc wanting to look like a narc, I guess. It was growing the hair long in the beard and looking like I hadn't taken a bath, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so I was buying a lot of street-level stuff there, mainly heroin and cocaine. And then after a few years there, then, you know, started developing better informant, cut my hair, shaved, started taking a bath. And before you know it, I was working bigger deals, you know, doing buy bus and doing reversals and a lot of it with my good friends in the DEA office there in El Paso, and really had a lot of fun doing that. And I saw myself staying there forever. I really did. And I remember my lieutenant walked into my little cubicle and said, "Hey, are you going to take the sergeant test?" I go, "Nah, why do I want to do that? I'm perfectly happy here." And then he told me something that really hit me. He said, "You know, Robert, don't let your job interfere with your career." And then you say, you know, you get promoted, you can always come back, and your experience will make you a better supervisor here. So because of that, I took the test, promoted to sergeant. I went to a police regional command, and I was there maybe 9 months in uniform as a chief sergeant. Then the captain selected me to form the station's first impact team, again, focusing on in-progress crimes. And then a few months later, they sent me back to narcotics as a sergeant. I oversaw the, or I was a sergeant in the street crime unit and the major crime unit. Then I promoted to lieutenant, went back to patrol for 13 months, then back to narcotics as a narcotic commander for about 7 years. And then I was the got promoted to captain. I oversaw directed investigation division, which was the narcotics guys, the gang guys, homicide guys, crime scene unit, repeat offender program. And the last 3 years of my career, I was the deputy chief in charge of the major crime bureau, which is basically all of the investigators. I had about 300 people under me. And then I retired. And that was my El Paso career. I was also very involved in the Texas Narcotic Officers Association. Eventually, I became president for three different times as president. I was also their executive director. I was also vice president for the National Narcotic Officers Association Coalition. So you can see the working dope drugs have been in my blood, and I'm actually still doing that.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about the drug trafficking issues around the border, since you sort of grew up down that way in terms of the crime and seeing how things have changed. You know, back when you started working narcotics and seeing the drugs come across from Mexico, what changes have you seen from then up to where we're at today?
Yeah, I think the biggest change is going to be in with the technology. We did a lot of cases on the border, and that involved crossover, doing control crossover, of course, working with U.S. Customs Border Patrol and DEA, and then following the Lozier stash houses. But back then, they used walkie-talkies. I'll say the lookouts. They had lookouts. They used walkie-talkies. Today, they're more sophisticated. They have cell phones. They have other modes of communication. More sophisticated. There's more of them. There's more cartel activity now than when I was working drugs. And actually, the drug coming across the border, most of the time was going to be marijuana. And, right. And now that changed a lot because of the legalization issue here. Now they're dealing with things that are much more dangerous to the law enforcement officer. I'm talking about fentanyl. They come in contact with that. Mm-hmm. That can kill the officer. So right. Things have changed in many ways.
So the fentanyl problem, obviously, is probably one of the biggest problems I think this country is facing right now, because we have a Chinese involvement in the fentanyl with the Mexican cartel traffickers. And as I know, that the Chinese are also laundering money for the cartels. So were you able to see that type of issues going on with any of the Chinese traffickers tied in with the Mexican cartels?
Yeah, actually, the Chinese have been tied in with the cartels for many, many years now.
Right.
Their involvement has increased quite a bit, especially recently. But the Chinese criminals working with the cartels, a lot of them are actually in Mexico, and they run these businesses, so-called, on the side. But a lot of them are directly involved with the cartels, and they've been doing that for a long time. Now, regarding the issue of fentanyl, I agree with you 100%. I think that's the biggest threat to our country right now. We're losing about 100,000 people a year due to these overdoses on fentanyl, oxycodone, on these opioids. You know, these little blue pills that come across the border, a lot of them, if not most of them, contain about 1.8 milligrams of fentanyl. It only takes you 2.2 milligrams to kill you. So until we get a handle on this situation, the bottom line, you're going to see more people dying in our country. Over here, speaking about the El Paso border, I did an interview on Fox and Friends about a month ago, and they had they first interviewed the DEA sack out of El Paso, Kyle Williamson, and I know him. He's a friend of mine, and he was talking about record amounts of drugs being seized there in the El Paso area, fentanyl, meth, cocaine. When it was my turn to speak, I said, you know, that's a lot of drugs. But consider that's what they see. Consider how much actually made it across to other cities in the United States. So that is our biggest threat. The other problem, Larry, is that the current situation, and I'm so happy to finally hear the president call it a crisis. It's been a crisis for a while, and it just irks me how they refuse to call it what it is. And it is a crisis, and our agents, DEA, U.S. Customs Border Patrol, HSI, all of them working the border are overwhelmed. They're understaffed, and they need help, and they need it now. So I'm hoping your viewers listening, will put pressure on their representatives to send some help, because they are quite frankly overwhelmed. And Border Patrol, what I'm doing is going down to the border area to do ride-alongs and with the officers and get a sense of what's going on in the border. Matter of fact, tomorrow I'm leaving for Laredo, and I'm going to be riding along working with the Webb County Sheriff's Department, probably going on some narcotic search warrants, stuff like that, and maybe hopefully talking to our Border Patrol agents. But I did a ride-along a couple of weeks ago in Kingsville, Texas, and there a few days, and we get a call, or the officers get a call, I'm with them, on about six illegal aliens jumping off the train, and the residents call in. Well, the officers have to respond, so you don't know, because you don't know who these people are, you don't know their arms. The next thing that came over the radio was that nobody from Border Patrol is available. That station, Border Patrol station in Kingsville, is a 300-man station, and nobody was available. You know why nobody was available? Because they're too busy babysitting.
Yeah.
They're not spending time where they should be. They're babysitting.
Yeah.
Eventually, a couple of agents did show up, but, I mean, I'm going in probably a different direction than started. But, I mean, that's what I'm seeing on the border. And, again, I'm sure I'm going to see the same thing tomorrow when I go down to Laredo. And I think it's important for me, especially teaching this class, that I stay on top of it. What's going on there, and that I can only do that by hanging out with our heroes that are actually on the front line. They actually are on ground zero when it comes to Mexican cartel activity.
Well, it's pretty much been the standard. I know in my career in law enforcement, you know, we try to remain apolitical, not get involved in politics, but just tell it like it is, tell the reality, tell the truth of what's actually taking place in our country and what's actually taking place on our border. I mean, you can cut it and slice it anyways, but until you talk to the men and women that work that border every day, nobody really knows what's going on. And now we see it firsthand. And I think, and I hope that this administration will do something about it instead of ignoring it. But we can't keep continuing to ignore this issue, because it's not just about, you know, these children being left alone. It's also the increase of drug smuggling and so many other things that they're doing with these children down there. Really taking advantage of the children, exploiting them. The cartels are exploiting them for sex trafficking and so on. So that, to me, is another big issue down there. So let's talk a little bit, Robert, about you were eventually appointed by President Obama in 2010, and you served as the U.S. Marshal for the Western District of Texas, and you were there for about 6 years. And, you know, I always give kudos to the U.S. Marshals, because a lot of times people just don't realize what the Marshals do. In a lot of sense, in the risk and dangers that they face as well. And I've had the opportunity to work with some of the deputies in my fugitive cases, and I can tell you, they were dedicated and they did an outstanding job. So let's talk a little bit about you becoming the U.S. Marshal.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, it truly was an honor, and it was an honor that I was not expecting. I didn't look for it. Actually was on my way to leave Seattle to teach a class, and I'm at the airport in Phoenix when my phone rings, and it's the Chief of Staff for Congressman Sylvester Reyes, and he tells me that Congressman wants to recommend me to the President as the U.S. Marshal for the Western District of Texas, and he asked if I was interested. Well, at first I thought it was a joke, right. And then I realized, you know, it is. I said, oh, absolutely, I'm interested. And I said, you know, even if I don't get it, I really appreciate the consideration from the congressman. And he said, no, you don't understand. We're going to get you in there. Sure enough, the congressman, with help and support from other congressmen, including Henry Cuellar, they were able to get the senators to support me, especially Senator Cornyn, who's always been a big supporter of mine when he was the Texas Attorney General, and I was overseeing the gang unit. He'd go to El Paso, so very pro-law enforcement. Apparently, he thought a lot of me and endorsed me, actually endorsed me on his website. Went through the Senate Judiciary Committee. I didn't have to be there, and then they forwarded my nomination to the floor, and I received unanimous confirmation, and then shortly thereafter sworn in, and that was just an incredible experience that I'll never forget. And then it was time to get to work. So the main office for the Western District of Texas is in San Antonio, but we also have that district also includes offices in Austin, Waco, Texas, Del Rio, Texas, Alpine, Texas, Midland, Texas, Bakers, Texas, and El Paso, Texas. So it's a huge area, and I hit the ground running, visited all these offices, and you're right, I got to see firsthand the outstanding work done by many of these deputy marshals, especially when it comes to finding somebody, tracking some people, wanted fugitive, and taking them off the streets. And I'm very proud that we were able to put together some major roundup operation going after people that had outstanding warrants. And the benefit of doing that is, well, first of all, these people are wanted. They need to answer for their crime. They need to answer for that warrant. So we need to place them under arrest. But another thing that happens, these people, many of them are just career criminals. That's all they're doing is they're committing crime. So when we take them off the street, well, that results in less crime because they're not out there committing these crimes. So I was very proactive. You have some marshals that will, you know, sit back and just let things happen. But I've never been that kind of person. I say we're gonna really, you know, do more. Not that you're not doing anything, but we're gonna do more. And I've always believed that we can always do more. So the deputy marshals are involved in many, many high profile cases. And then I really was happy that we could assist our state and local agency when they had a suspect wanted for murder in Mexico and end up fleeing to Mexico. And many, many times we were able to work with our counterparts in Mexico to locate them, arrest them, and have them extradited back to answer for those charges. So many things involved with the marshal service, and then also going after the sex offenders, enforcing the Adam Walsh Act. That was also high on my list, taking these sex offenders off the street.
Right. So I know you spent 6 years working in the marshals. So how did it come about where you put everything together, of course, based on all of your experience and training, and you started, I guess, for the lack of a better word, developing a profile on what the Mexican cartels felt that they had some outside protection from law enforcement. Tell us a little bit about that and how that came about.
Yeah, actually, I think it's kind of a funny story, but that all started when I was a narcotics detective in El Paso. And, you know, we would execute search warrants on a lot of heroin, street-level heroin dealers. And I remember we would go into the homes on a search warrant, clear the house, of course, and then start looking around. And many, many of these drug homes had little altars, shrines set up, if you will, a little table with candles burning and things of that nature and religious statues. And I was always intrigued about this kind of stuff. So I remember one time actually looking at this altar, studying it, and I saw a statue of Jesus Christ. And right behind the statue of Jesus Christ was a baggie containing several balloons of heroin. So found that, and then, of course, placed the person under arrest. And I asked the person, why did you have the heroin behind Jesus Christ? And her response was, well, he's supposed to protect me from you. Well, you know, that struck me. That struck me. And then, of course, I had to comment, you know, my smart, sarcastic comment, well, you know, it didn't work. Well, then, this is how she responded, and I'll never forget this. Her response was, yes, I guess I need to pray harder. So that told me right off the bat that their belief in the power of prayer and in the power of prayer protecting them from law enforcement is unconditional. It's embedded in their soul, their hearts, their minds. It's ongoing, and no matter what happened to them, it's unconditional. So that intrigued me back then. And then I remember another thing that did that was we hit the house of another heroin dealer who was a bruja. And a lot of your bruja, excuse me, a lot of your listeners may not know what a bruja is, but a bruja is a witch. And I talk about the witches, the brujas and the curanderos, the healers in my class when I talk about the Mexican cartels, because the Mexican cartels use them, and they'll actually use them to put hexes on police officers. Well, anyway, getting back to this case, I go up to a similar table as I described earlier, and I see the same thing, prayer candle statues, and I see a couple of voodoo dolls. I've never seen voodoo dolls in person. And I look at the voodoo doll, and they got pins stuck through pieces of paper with writing on the paper into the doll. Mm-hmm. Now, my partner, big, tall guy, Joe, didn't like any of this stuff. Even the regular, you know, legitimate prayer candle, he wanted to get close to it. And I said, come on, Joe, check this out, man. You saw where they found I found heroin here. He said, no, man, I don't believe in that. I don't believe in that. But just in case, I don't want to get close. So, you know, that kind of stuff. So anyway, I pick up a voodoo doll, and I go, holy Joe. He goes, what? And I go, your name's on this. And he goes, shut up. Put that down. That's not funny. And so I go, no, man, I'm serious. I walked towards him, and I showed it to him. And, man, I could see that it really affected him. You know, the big, tall guy, and I never seen him so scared. And then and I felt for him. We're good friends, you know, with my partner, and I saw how it affected him. So I did probably what any cop or you guys in DEA would have done. I laughed.
Yeah,
I laughed at him. You know, that's what we do with cops, right?
Yeah.
And I even told him, hey, you're eating lunch by yourself today, man. I don't even want you in my car today. So anyway, I'm laughing. I put it down and I pick up the second one and I tell him, hey, this is not funny. This isn't funny anymore, man, because my name was on there. So that's when I realized, you know, what they do. And I teach that in my training when I'm training law enforcement officers, because they're still doing that, Larry. They're still doing hexes on police officers. And, you know, I'll ask the police officers, hey, how many of you are concerned if you would see your name on a voodoo doll or your name inside a cow's tongue or your name underneath on a piece of paper underneath a statue Santa Muerte? And a lot of officers say, no, I won't. I go, well, you should be concerned. And they look at me strange, and why are you saying that? Well, I'm not talking about being concerned about the supernatural aspect of any type of a hex or spell. My concern is to what extent will they go to make the hex come true?
Right.
Especially in today's time with all the anti-police stuff, I tell these officers, you need to be aware of your surroundings. You need to be sure you're not being followed home, followed from the office. You're not under surveillance. You know, that kind of stuff. I'm not trying to make them paranoid. Just trying to make them safer and more careful. So anyway, Then I just, you know, would encounter these more and more throughout my career working narcotics in El Paso. And even as a marshal, I remember one time in a courtroom, one of my guys saw somebody putting like some powder a spectator in the back of the courtroom, some powder and chicken feathers on the floor, doing a hex for a favorable outcome in the court case for their relatives. So this thing, you know, now back then it was pretty much Jesus Christ, the Virgin Mary, and, and a bunch of different Catholic saints. Now it changed a lot. Oh, we're still seeing Jesus. We're still seeing the Virgin Mary and a lot of Catholic saints. But now they've added to it. They've added Santa Muerte. They've added Jesus, Madre Verde, San Simón. So many different ones. So I spent a lot of time training the officers on who the cartels and gangs pray to for protection from them.
So with the it shows you how really dangerous the cartels are, because they really do their homework. They do their own intelligence gathering on law enforcement. And so, you know, even back when I was working narcotics, even as a, you know, undercover cop and then going to DEA, I always kept my head on a swivel, because they kept telling us, you got to know what's behind you, for sure, especially when you leave the office. And, you know, and the cartels are well known for doing counter surveillance. It's a fact of life. I mean, I got exposed to it out in California and some other places. But so anyways, I know you've testified in both state and federal courts as an expert witness regarding these cartels. Tell us a little bit what they look for, have looked for on using you as an expert on these cartels for, you know, these different religious statues and so on.
Well, they, what they're looking for, when we're talking about prosecutors reaching out to me to testify in court. Matter of fact, before I took your phone call, I was on the phone with an immigration hearing officer out of Canada, and talking about a an immigration case which I may testify on, involving a cartel member, a former cartel member. So anyway, those are the kind of situations. And as far as the other cases, there are most of them, or really all of them, are drug cases, and they're usually mid to upper level drug cases. And those are going to be, they have been different cases where the officer doing the investigation, DEA, DEA task force officers doing the investigation, would encounter some of the patron saints that I talked about. Very often, some of the officers involved in the investigation had attended my training. They mentioned that to the prosecutor. So the prosecutor asked me to come and testify about the different icons, the pictures, the statues, the tattoos, prayer candles, different things that they may have been wearing. And I think it's very important for me to say this, because when I'm teaching my class, and I reiterate many times that all of the different patron saints, including Santa Muerte and Jesus Malverde, none of them are probable cause for search or arrest. They're meant to be, first and foremost, red flags as far as officer safety enhancement. That's what I want. And after that, to see if it turns into an indicator, depending on what other information you have or what else you see there at the scene. So I testified in state and federal court in Texas, I believe Arkansas, I believe South Carolina, and New Mexico, Albuquerque, as well as Dodge City, Kansas, so far.
Yeah, it's a very interesting understanding about the mindset of the cartels, because you're looking really at their mindset when you're talking about these patron saints or, you know, the protection from law enforcement. So talk to us a little bit about, I know you wrote some books. Talk to us a little bit about some books that you wrote.
Yeah, I wrote a couple of books, and actually I wrote those so many years ago, to be honest, I'm not even sure if they're in print anymore. And they were originally meant as college textbooks on managing covert in investigations. And I'm actually writing a new book right now, and I want to say I'm probably around 60% complete, and I'm writing a book on everything that we've been talking about, Larry, the cartels and everything that they're involved in, their their culture, which includes their extracurricular activities. The cartels are here in the United States. You and I know that. When you and I were working the streets, we're working them here in the United States, and they've been here. The big difference now between the time you and I were working and now is that there's more of them here, without a doubt, and get ready because more of them are coming. They're more powerful. They're more powerful now. So I'm writing a book on that. And when I do my training, the officers, I tell them, look, you need to focus on the Mexican cartel, not just when they have the drugs, or you're on a wire or anything like that, or on a search warrant. You need to pay attention. They're here. So you need to pay attention to their extracurricular activities. And that's why I've done extensive research on their involvement, or at least attendance to cockfights. Mexican cartels and gangs love cockfights. And there's many, many cockfights that have occurring here in the United States. Matter of fact, 2 weeks ago, maybe less than 2 weeks ago, in South Fulton, Georgia, they took down a cockfight, and they actually found about a meth lab at that cockfight, an actual meth lab where they were making methamphetamine, a Mexican cartel, and they found about 80 pounds of the finished product. And that's why I talk about the cockfight. I also talk about the horse races. They love horse races, and I'm not talking about going to the Kentucky Derby, although some do. I'm talking about them setting up their own private horse races in the rural areas, and I attended one doing some intel gathering for some cops out in Georgia last year, intel gathering, getting some license plate numbers, video, stuff like that. So that's the kind of research I'm doing. And then I also talk about the Narco Corrido concerts, the music of the cartel, and I make it very clear that not everybody attending these concerts is a drug trafficker. But hey, if I'm a cartel member and I'm working out of Dodge City, Kansas, and a group's coming that I like, I'm going to be there. And guess what? I'm going to be at a VIP table. And that's when I go to these concerts, that's where I like to hang out and rub elbows with these guys. Matter of fact, I'm going to one this Saturday, as a matter of fact. So I'm constantly doing the research on stuff. So I think that's what we need to pay more attention to. Just like we're talking about the Brujas and the Curanderos. Well, they have businesses throughout the United States. And again, most of the people that are running these locations are good, honest people, most of them. And a lot of people, I would say most of the people that go visit them are people that want help with physical or spiritual issues. However, you have Mexican cartels that will go to them, and they'll have a limpia, or what's known as the cleansing, performed on them or their low vehicle. And just about a month ago, a cop in Georgia who had been to my class called me, where they did surveillance, followed a guy to one of these locations. And when he left, they got him stopped, and he had about 20 pounds of meth. And that's exactly what I'm talking about. We need to stay on the heels of the Mexican cartel. We need to stay on them, not let them catch their breath. And if every agency in every city would do this, then we're sending a message to them, the cartels and the gangs. Look, we're going to make it as difficult as possible for you to operate in our city, because we're going to hit you with everything we got, and we're not going to let what's happening in Mexico happen over here. That's my concern,
right?
Because my concern is increase in shootouts and things of that nature involving the cartel. The cartels are already doing hits over here in the United States. They've been doing it for a while,
right?
And they're saying they're hit teams out here and they're hitting people. So I just don't want to see that get any worse. And that's why I get excited at being able to talk to cops about the cartels.
Well, yeah. And as time goes on, the Mexican cartels, they'll assimilate into the lifestyle of here in the U.S. And actually they're now part of that fabric, just like the Italian organized crime criminals, when they started growing way back when, you know, they try to legitimatize their businesses. And then they were running unions and scams and on and on. And I think the Mexican cartels are probably more powerful now than the mafia here in the U.S. because of the money that they have access to is just mind-boggling. And we're not talking millions. We're talking billions, more than some of the governments, especially in Mexico and Central America.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and that's why these cartels are doing what they do, and it's all about money. And I do a 2.5-day class that's actually sponsored by the Midwest Counter Drug Training Center. I have a contract with them, and I just did that class last week, virtual training in Iowa. And for any of your law enforcement listeners, this training is free. Training is free. All they got to do is go to the mctc.com and look for my class. And they have a lot of other good classes as well. And this training is free. But I encourage the officers to do that. And I've got other trainings that are set up. I'm sure, I know we're going to talk about how to find out at the end of this presentation. But if I can continue on to talking a little bit about Mexico, I interviewed a kidnap victim 3 weeks ago. He was kidnapped by, and I videotaped it. I'm getting it edited right now. And he was kidnapped by the Mexican cartel, held for 5 days. Now, this kid was not a drug trafficker. He was a good kid, came from a good family. And the reason they kidnapped him was because his family had money. His family owned businesses. And he's leaving a nightclub one night, and he's not paying attention. He's texting while driving. And then all of a sudden, he gets locked in. They pull him out of the vehicle at gunpoint, put him in a van, take him to the location, threatening him threatening him that they were going to kill him. Well, eventually, he was released after his family paid $500,000 in ransom. This is what the cartel do, yeah. And that's what they're going to continue to do. Now, people, this issue about legalizing marijuana, you know, people have said legalize marijuana and the cartels go away. That's completely false, completely wrong. It's not about marijuana. It's not just about drugs. It's about criminal activity. The Mexican cartels are involved in extortion and kidnapping. They're tapping pipelines in Mexico. And I got to tell you, people ask me, well, what is it going to take to change what's going on in Mexico? Well, you have to end one thing, and it's all tied to one word, and that one word is corruption. There is so much corruption at all levels in the Mexican government, unfortunately, right. That until that changes, nothing is going to change. This kidnap victim, when I asked him basically, you know, do you see this changing? And he said, no. And I go, even if they legalize all the drugs in the U.S., no, it's not going to change. He said, you know, it's sad. I love Mexico. That's my country. But it's never going to change because of the corruption. Right. So it's really a sad situation, but that just it is what it is.
Sure. Well, I know having a lot of friends that were stationed in Colombia, how the government of Colombia really took their country back, and it has to happen in Mexico for them to get their country back. Because the cartels are running the government, not the opposite way.
Yeah.
So until that changes, until the Mexican government decides to crack down on these cartels, it's going to continue as the same old thing.
That's exactly right. And things won't change. You know, this president, Obrador, came in saying, well, we're going to change it. There is no more war. We're going to not go after the cartel. Well, he's living up to that, but nothing's improved. The cartels are in charge. Look at what happened in 2019 when they captured Ovidio Guzman, one of Chapo Guzman's sons. This was, they had him in custody, and Ivan, Chapo, Ovidio's brother, called for backup, and a lot of Sinaloa cartel members showed up, and they forced the Mexican government to release him, and the president ordered him released. And this is a black eye to the governor of Mexico and tells you who's in charge. Something like that, Larry, would never happen in the United States. I don't care what the situation is. So the cartels are out of control over there. And Obrador, instead of focusing on the cartel, he's attacking DEA in the United States, saying right. that DEA agents are corrupt and that they right. Fabricated evidence against that Cienfuegos, who they released, was another story, by the way.
The justice
and then
minister.
Recently, he came. Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. And he was corrupt. There's no doubt. I know an officer that personally, a good friend of mine, involved in that investigation, and it was just a sad state of affairs.
Yeah.
And there's so many other cases to talk about, but this guy Obrador is, and then recently he came out. You know how we're looking for Caro Quintero. He was released right. Prematurely. Mm-hmm. We're looking for Caro Quintero. And then Obrador had to come out and make a statement, hey, I agree with the court releasing him. What kind of bullshit is that? Pisses me off.
Yeah.
So he's over here making comments more that are more positive toward the cartel than for law enforcement, Mexican and U.S. law enforcement. So it probably tells, it riles me up a little bit.
No, I mean, some people may not know that Carol Quintero was responsible for the death of DEA agent Enrique Kiki Camarena. And this has been going, this has been a battle, well, that's been going on since 1983, when they captured and killed Camarena. So it's been going on for a long time. And, you know, people don't realize that we cannot get the cooperation sometimes of the Mexican government with even their own criminals that they protect, which is the unfortunate situation that goes on every day.
Yeah, well, just another thing about that case with Cienfuegos, the defense minister, is that not only did Obrador badmouth DEA and accuse them of fabricating evidence, but he actually violated a treaty between the U.S. and Mexico by releasing evidence on that investigation. And our government is not holding him responsible for that. And then he's making it, he removed a lot of diplomatic immunity for our DEA agents.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And they made it more difficult for investigations to occur, even begin in the United States. Because anytime any Mexican law enforcement officer get information from any U.S. law enforcement officer, they got to run that up the chain.
Right.
Well, that's ridiculous. How many informants are going to be killed? How many cases are going to be ruined? It's just incredible. So Obrador is not with us. Obrador is against us. And it's very, very unfortunate. And I feel bad for the good people of Mexico, because overwhelmingly most of the people in Mexico are good, and they're tired and they're fed up and they need help.
Yeah. And we have a lot of big cities like that here in the United States, where a lot of people are fed up with the shootings and crimes that go on every day. And we have a lot of good people.
Absolutely.
We have a lot of good people that live in the inner cities. I happen to work some of them. And the problem is they're stuck in dealing with these criminals every day, because the political spectrum sort of now has changed and not putting these guys in prison where they truly belong. And it's the same in Mexico. So let me ask you this now. So I know you're doing some outstanding training throughout the country and educating our law enforcement officers. So Robert, how do we get in touch with you, or how does a law enforcement agency or anyone that's interested in your training?
Okay, well, my training on Mexican cartels is specific to law enforcement officers. However, I can tweak it for a general audience with not involving law enforcement. I can certainly do that. For law enforcement officers, my training consists of sensitive investigations, even some ongoing investigations. So you can see why I limit it to law enforcement and military as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as far as getting a hold of me, a couple of things. I have a website. That website is robertalmonte.com, robertalmontealtogether.com. So it's robertalmonte.com, and I have a listing of my classes that are set up right now. We're always updating it. And then my email is robert@robertalmonte.com, altogether, robert@robertalmonte.com.
And that's ALMONTE.
That's it. That is exactly it. And again, I can tailor my training, my presentation to any group. As I mentioned, I do a 2.5-day class on the cartel, talking about anything and everything about them. But I also can tailor my presentation to do a talk at a luncheon or something like that.
Well, Robert, listen, it's been an honor. It's been educational. And I appreciate you taking the time to come on our podcast.
Well, I'll tell you what, I've enjoyed it, and it's been my honor. It really has, and I appreciate the opportunity to share with your listeners what's going on with the Mexican cartels and talk about my training as well. Thank you, Larry.
Forletta Investigates.
Thank you for listening to Forletta Investigates. Subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You could follow Forletta Investigative Security Consultants on LinkedIn and at FCIS LLC on Facebook. And if you are in need of investigative or security services, please go to FCISLLC.com.